I'd like, first of all, this evening to put these three talks into some kind of perspective. Man has reached the stage in his evolutionary progress, or process, if you don't think of it in terms of progress, where he is now becoming, and this is happening very fast, responsible for his own destiny. Now, you may regard that as an extreme statement. Well, humanity, certainly in the Western world, is almost in extremis. So therefore, an extreme statement is appropriate to the present situation, to the contemporary state of things. In this country, this became conscious, in the religious world, it became a conscious factor in the religious world with the writing of the book Honest to God by Bishop John Robinson, where he put forward the thesis that God is the ground of our being, no more, no less, and yet that is everything. And you may recall that this caused a tremendous stir at the time. But this began to seep into religious consciousness. As far as religious consciousness is concerned, it takes a very long time for things to seep. But nevertheless, it is seeping, and the effects are becoming apparent. Nevertheless, in spite of that, there is still a great deal of looking outward for some kind of intervention into the human situation from a God who is out there, someone, some person, some being, some entity who will intervene. Now, if one stopped to reflect and be aware, one would realize that this is completely out of accord with this understanding of God as the ground of our being. The curious thing is that this is carried right over into what is called, wrongly so, New Age consciousness. All right, the old concept of a God out there was that of the church looking toward a second coming in physical terms, when Jesus Christ would intervene in world affairs from outside in some physical way. Now, there's been a carryover of that into esoteric circles, and you can see it manifesting in many different ways. A way of interpreting the phrase in the great invocation, "May Christ return to earth," and a body came into being or came into prominence not so long ago, which declared that the Christ is now in Geneva and he has his special emissary and he's sending out messages. That's just one aspect. The other aspect is the looking for what has been called the externalization of the hierarchy. Someone, some group of people are coming in from outside or coming from somewhere and they are going to redeem the situation. Or in the UFO world, there are those who see some kind of landings from outer space that are going to be these greater beings who will intervene and lift us up. They'll do something about the present world situation. And so there are many groups which, having rejected the old concept of a God from without, are in a curious way bringing in the new concept. This isn't new. That great woman, Annie Besant, to whom we owe so much in the evolution of spiritual consciousness, fell into this very trap herself. And this is epitomized in the story when she and a group of her followers set off for Austria because at last one of the great masters was going to reveal himself from his hideout in the mountains, in the Alps. Well, it turned out to be a fiasco because here again, as I say, she had fallen into the trap. And this is so deep in the human psyche, looking for external help, that whilst part of us can accept the fact, yes, that God is the ground of our being, another part of us, because it is so deeply rooted, is looking for someone, something from outside. Now, this has to go. If man is responsible for his destiny, and if God is the ground of our being, then it's all within us. It's within the aggregate of humanity, if it's to be found at all. And if it isn't to be found, then this is going to be the end of humanity. Now, here again is another trap into which we can fall. And I note this in some of the movements today, excellent movements in themselves, which oppose this, that and the other, from nuclear warfare to the rape of the earth. Now, all these ideas are excellent. But if in the promulgation of these ideas there is the generation of anxiety, then something is wrong. Something is wrong. It's being done in the wrong kind of way. And if it's necessary to resort to violence almost to propagate these ideas, again, we're falling into a trap. We're being destroyed by the very ideas that we propagate. So that is a preamble, if you like, to these three talks. They are concerned with the responsibility that is ours. It may be, and I'm not a pessimist, I'm an optimist by now, it may be too late. It may well be too late, even with the forming of a centre party in this country. And that could be a very good thing indeed, or a bad thing, according to your point of view. It could at least stop the polarisation that we've now reached in the political arena. It may be too late. Nevertheless, it is not too late for an evolution of our own consciousness. It is not too late for mankind, where there is willingness to respond to the potential and the possibility that is still within the human psyche. Now, this evening, I want to speak particularly of ancient wisdom and its relationship to the new consciousness. And I take as my starting point a quotation from the New Testament, words written by St. Paul in his letter to the Christians at Corinth. "I speak words of wisdom to those who are ripe for it, not a wisdom belonging to this passing age, nor to any of its governing powers. I speak God's hidden wisdom, his secret purpose, formed from the very beginning to bring us to our full glory." I'm going to read that again because it is, to me, a very wonderful statement, and it's very easy, especially for those of us who've read it and read it and read it and not heard it. It's very easy for us not to hear it. "I speak words of wisdom to those who are ripe for it, not a wisdom belonging to this passing age, nor to any of its governing powers. I speak God's hidden wisdom, his secret purpose, formed from the very beginning to bring us to our full glory." And if you like a textual reference, it's 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 6. So it's all there in the book. Now here we have, I believe, in a single statement, what might be considered to be all the elements which together make up that which is commonly referred to as the ancient wisdom. And sometimes you hear people speaking in very hushed terms of the ancient wisdom. It's very difficult to get at indeed. Well, it's been there on the printed page of the New Testament for almost 2,000 years. It is interesting to note in passing that these are the words of one frequently seen as the great founder of institutional Christianity. May we then first take a brief look at these elements to see what in essence they are, at the characteristics of the age in which we live, and then try to see something of their relevance for this age. Now we note first of all that the wisdom of which this writer, St. Paul, speaks is communicated to those who are ripe for it, a lovely phrase for which we are indebted to the translators of the New English Bible. Now, the clear implication here is that ripeness on the part of the recipient is essential for the realization of this wisdom. Indeed, without such ripeness, this wisdom is incomprehensible and dissolves into nothing more than factual information. And so let us be clear at the outset that wisdom of any kind constitutes something more than knowledge. Secondly, this wisdom is declared to be ageless, for it does not belong to any one passing age. It is divorced from the thought forms of any one culture, any one code of ethics or morality. It is not limited to a particular period of history or any one stage in the evolution of man. It is timeless, that is, eternal. It spans all the ages and is relevant to every period of history. Its function is to inform history and invest it with meaning and to give hope to society. And this leads us to the third of these characteristics. It constitutes the substance of the divine plan for humanity, a plan hidden from man's natural sense perceptions. Now, we shall come at the later on to this whole consideration, or we shall just look very briefly at this whole consideration of how do we as individuals or as groups relate to the present crisis and indeed to this wisdom. It is on the level of perception, and this is at the heart of grasping the ancient wisdom and relating to the new consciousness. The level of direct perception. Now, this is not the level of society's operation in the face of desperate situations at the moment. Look briefly at the political scene. The Tory party comes together in its annual conference. It's coming together, and the situation is analysed, the world situation, the country's situation. It is analysed, and after the process of analysis, there comes a course of action or proposed actions which are proposed on the basis of analysis, which are always incomplete. In fact, they're wrong, as are those of the trade unions and as are those of the Socialist Party, and as, unless Mrs. Shirley Williams can bring another dimension into it, will be the perceptions of the Centre Party. Because what is desperately needed in society, and before that can happen, this must come right into spiritual consciousness amongst those who profess a religious faith, is an understanding of direct perception, not perception as a result of analysis, but seeing right through. And this is what contemplative meditation is all about. It's about the whole of life. Now, I'm going ahead of myself, but I want to go ahead of myself, so forgive my doing it this evening. And of course, there have been great forerunners of this. Rudolf Steiner, when he talked of his language is the language of the esoteric schools, which doesn't speak to many people today, even people who are aware of the new consciousness. He spoke of tapping into the Akashic records. Well, that's fine for those who understand that kind of language. Gurdjieff had a great deal to say about this, and his concern was that the human machine should, or the patterns of the human machine, should so be stopped and broken that the faculty for direct perception would be released. One of the great prophets of our day, who is now in his 80s, is Krishnamurti. And Krishnamurti rejects all techniques, he rejects all systems, and says it's the present moment, it's now. Well, all this is a contribution to what is necessary in our age, and it must come amongst those who say they are searching for a spiritual path, and then it can be translated into the political situation, the economic situation, the whole of life. And that is the spiritual discipline of direct perception, contemplative meditation. We'll come to that later. Here, then, in brief, is in the context of, indeed, at the very heart of the Christian religion, we have enshrined a great signpost to the essential elements of an ageless wisdom, elements which are in complete accord with that wisdom known to the great mystery schools, found in the secret traditions of all ancient civilizations, often encapsulated within the context of formal religion, and consciously carried forward by the esoteric schools in every generation. Let me now take a broad perspective of the age in which we live, or should one perhaps say the ages in which we live. For on any count, we're living at the meeting point of many worlds today. It is a tremendous privilege. It is a great problem, but let us remember it is a tremendous privilege. We're living in a twilight era, in the passing away of the old and the coming to birth of the new. In the passing of the old, we witness the disappearance of the frameworks of society as it has been known for centuries in the West, the breaking down of hierarchical structures, the disintegration of former concepts of morality with its accompanying lawlessness and license. the dissolution of old political and social patterns, and fundamental changes in educational techniques. No aspect of society remains unchanged. And here I quote from what I have written elsewhere in Spiritual Man in a New Age. The pessimists, supported by Toynbee's assessment of what is happening, see all the signs of the end of a civilization, preceding perhaps total catastrophe. The Marxists see the crumbling of the great capitalist systems, preceding the birth of true social justice and communism. The religious apocalyptics and fundamentalists see the approaching end of the world, whilst many see the signs of the parousia, or the second coming of Christ. All these attempts to explain what is happening contain elements of possibility and truth. What is abundantly clear and beyond dispute is that we are in the midst of a great crisis point in the history of man. And from this situation goes up the cry, where lies reality and the road to sanity? But parallel to this shaking of the foundations, the great disruption of society, there is another element of change which, if we are to gain a balanced perspective, must now be taken into account. And this change relates to the coming to birth of the new. Since the late 19th century in the Western world, there has been growing within the consciousness of a steadily increasing number an awareness of the dawning of some interior change, a change within man, an eruption of new life within human consciousness. Mystics, scientists, philosophers, poets and artists sharing in this consciousness have struggled, some consciously, others intuitively, to express and interpret and relate it to the great external upheavals of our day. I was fascinated recently. Someone pointed out to me a course arranged by the Extramural Department of London University on the new mysticism in science, in religion, in art, in every discipline. And this was being dealt with as a very serious study course, an acknowledgement of something happening, not from the religious perspective at all. Some of you may, and this is not the commercial for the evening, some of you may have read Omega News, our new bi-monthly broadsheet, which is concerned with the new consciousness in religion, science, medicine and the arts. It is coming to birth everywhere. And if you go back and read some of your favourite books by some of the philosophers and writers, seers, poets, scientists of 25, 30 years ago, you'll find there a dawning awareness of what was happening. Read Aldous Huxley's books, written before the last war. And I was reading one of his books recently. What was it called? I can't remember. Means and Ends. And I nearly jumped out of my seat with excitement. 40 to 50 years ago, this book was written, and he's saying all these things. He was aware of it because, although he was agnostic in many ways, he was developing the faculty of direct perception. He was relating this, all right, to processes of analysis as well, because he was a very brilliant man intellectually. But at the heart of his intellectualism was direct perception. And therefore, he saw, without knowing that he saw, and knew without knowing that he knew, all that which was coming. Now, a variety of theories have been put forth concerning what is happening. These range from that of an evolutionary leap to changes in the life of the planet resulting from the beginning of a new astrological cycle. So it's all in the stars, it's all up there. Within the context of the great eruption from within, men and women have arisen prophets and seers, individuals of great intellectual and spiritual stature and from great diversity of background, whose writings and interpretations have powerfully shaped the soul and directed the thinking of Western man. As I say, not all have done so consciously. Nevertheless, their contribution has been nonetheless significant. Among scientists and philosophers, Huxley, Polanyi, Bergson and Shaw, to name but a few, have played their part, whilst men such as Ouspensky and Teilhard de Chardin have consciously linked the disciplines of philosophy and science with mystical understanding in order to produce a rationale cognizant of spiritual values. Jung, Maslow and lately Saggioli have contributed to an understanding of the nature of man in Western psychology, where consciousness has shifted from centering in a self which is to be denied and destroyed to a higher self wherein lies a potential for tremendous good. Parallel to the opening up of the world of the unconscious by Freud and Jung came the unfolding and interpretation of theosophy and anthroposophy by Annie Besant and Rudolf Steiner. And although their contribution to human self-knowledge is generally unacceptable both to religion and to science in the West, their influence on the interpretation of the 20th century crisis has been considerable. Alice Bailey's name stands out amongst those who seek to give an interpretation of man's inner unfolding, past, present and future, and we have most of her books here in the library. Whilst the influence of Gurdjieff's teaching in the sphere of spiritual disciplines continues to grow. These are but some of those who have emerged prominently among the forerunners of the new consciousness. In the late 50s and 60s, this new consciousness, which had hitherto been the experience of individuals, began to express itself in group situations, and we saw the formation of what have been called the New Age centres. These centres differ widely in form and structure, and they appear and disappear rapidly, each having its own particular ethos and emphasis. What they have in common is a search for true understanding of what is now happening, and to try and establish growth points for the new society. At best, through the practice of spiritual disciplines, commonly called techniques of transformation, they have endeavoured to develop an inner resonance with the current changes. It has been characteristic of the centres that at their best, the awareness they have cultivated has related to the current changes, embracing concern for simplicity of lifestyle, social responsibility and cooperation with the evolving life of the planet. As a result of the group consciousness fostered by these centres, powerful psychic forces have been released, and it must be said that this has not always led to positive results. The coming together of sensitive individuals, sensitive that is on the psychic and emotional level, has frequently resulted in the proliferation of psychic perceptions which, divorced from wisdom, have led to illusion and delusion. And this is happening all around us, not necessarily on a very deep level, but it is happening. All over the place, groups are coming together to meditate. They know not why, but they feel they must come together to be silent together. That's fine. But unless a sense of direction develops, then at some point there is bound to be, well, let's experiment in this direction. I've heard of this. Let's try this. Oh, there's a group over there doing this, and they can see this, that, and the other when they come together in silence. And if you hold your breath for so long, you may see something, or even better, you may hear something. Now, this kind of thing can lead to confusion. It can lead to disintegration. So what is need is understanding and wisdom. All too often there has been an accompanying aura of romanticism and an inability through the absence of valid spiritual disciplines to harness the energies in unselfish ways. The combination of new ideas, powerfully coupled with psychic energies, has produced New Age thought forms largely divorced from experience. We are now moving toward the end of the first stage of New Age realization, with its exciting discovery of new dimensions and potentials. And the harsh realities, which in many New Age circles have until now been happily referred to in terms of apocalyptic generalities, are beginning painfully to emerge as economic, social and political pressures which are being felt by the centres themselves. And all too often now, paths are being offered which are pure escapism. every day, almost every day, I get in the mail here brochures, often with people with ravishing smiles on the front, offering all kinds of techniques for exploration of the lower psyche. And they're vying with one another for new language. They don't seem to run out, you know. You can do this, you can do that, you can turn psychic spiritual somersaults, you can have a weekend when you do everything you feel like doing, you know, a natural dance for the whole weekend. How you can go on doing natural dance from Friday night to Sunday afternoon, I really don't know. And often you fast at the same time, and you probably pay £80 at the end of it for the privilege of doing it. Well, everybody's getting in on the bandwagon. Now, there's an amusing side to this. There is a dangerous side, because there's total confusion. People not knowing where they're going. There's some force which can be used for good indeed, which is propelling so many people onward. We must go somewhere, and it's bound to be good. It is not bound to be good at all. It is not bound to be good. It can be the very reverse, and it can precipitate people into the very abyss which we all talk about avoiding. So, in the present situation, there are those who will be drawn irresistibly in the direction of glamour and continuing excitement, and this will lead into a cul-de-sac of escapism from the harsh realities of life as they confront us at the end of the century. On the other hand, for those who are prepared to pay the price, there will be the finding of the true self. And here is a paradox, for this is a self larger than the individual, and this will give birth to true group consciousness, symbolized and prefigured by the centers. It is in this context that we must now examine the relevance of the ancient wisdom. But lest we be tempted at this point to think of them and us, that is, of those who are on the wrong path and those who are on the right path, which of course is us, we do well to remind ourselves that the dichotomy, the division I have just referred to, exists in varying degrees within every one of us. Let us return now and look a little more closely at this wisdom as we have briefly defined it, and see how the wisdom of all the ages can inform the present spiritual crisis and the upheavals through which society is now passing. You will recall the primary ingredient of ripeness, or capacity to realize, and it is here that we must begin. Some time ago, I was asked to speak on the subject of a Christian initiation at a conference. My impression during the discussion which followed was that within the audience there was a certain amount of disappointment at my failure to unfold some new exotic rite which would instantaneously, not to say glamorously, give enlightenment. Curiously enough, the 2,000-year-old rite of baptism and the laying on of hands were barely considered in this context. I suspect that they are both thought to have been so devalued by the system that they are now regarded as irretrievably Piscean. The mystery schools to which we have referred had their rites of initiation, as have all the great religions, and also the esoteric schools. And all these were all right for their time and informed as far as possible the ages to which they belonged. It is of the essence of ripeness in the age into which mankind is now moving, not that he should subject himself to initiations effected from without and symbolized by external rites, but to a new awakening within himself. Now let me say at once that these need not necessarily be divorced from symbolic rites, but we're now concerned with the essence. It is of the essence of the wisdom for which we must, it is of the essence of ripeness in order that we may avail ourselves of the ancient wisdom that we awake within. In other words, as Bishop Robinson indicated in his book, in terms of a new potential, man has come of age and must begin, as Rudolf Steiner so clearly said, to take full responsibility for and control of his own destiny. To understand this is, I believe, a fundamental requirement if we are to perceive the signs of the time and grasp the present opportunity. And this is not easy for any of us. For those nurtured within the great religious institutions, which for 2,000 years have shaped our history as a nation and provided often paternalistic direction within clearly defined doctrinal and ethical structures, a transition into the very substance of those realities, hitherto safely enshrined in doctrine and dogma, can be not only difficult, but as traumatic as the passing of a camel through the eye of a needle. It's all been out there, over there, safe and secure, and I relate to it safely and securely from over here. But it is not only the religious who have a problem here, in case you're just saying, well, I'm not very religious, so I'm all right. The experience may be no less easy for those whose thought patterns and attitudes have been shaped within the esoteric schools which have been so active since the 19th century. The great changes to which I have referred already have not only made a profound impact upon traditional religious institutions, they have, if I may say so, caught unawares some of the esoteric schools which have played such a significant part in preparing the way for the new consciousness. And some of them don't like it at all. Oh, but we prepared the way for all this. For centuries, my secret society has taught people, and we've been taught very privately and secretly, and we've kept it to ourselves. Now everybody's talking about it. It isn't fair. Well, it's not, you know, it's like mother with the child sometimes. Hey, stop looking at my child, look at me. Or father too, perhaps more often father. It's a law of the spiritual life enunciated so clearly by Jesus that to find life one must lose it, and that resurrection follows death. The old schools existed in secret. That which was hidden for ages upon ages is now bursting forth within the consciousness of society itself. Secrecy is neither possible nor necessary. As a result, what is happening not infrequently makes unnecessary the work of parent societies which help to bring the new consciousness to birth with a paternalism and authoritarianism now unacceptable. Even the language of those schools, satisfying and effective as it has been within the context of secret societies, when poured into the stream of a contemporary vocabulary, seems quite archaic, if romantically so. Which brings me to the second ingredient of this wisdom, that is, its agelessness. It is not, in my understanding, a body of static truth which can be transmitted in the form of a special catechism, parallel to the traditional preparation for admission into religion. Rather is it to do with the dynamic which operates within man himself. The expression of the dynamic may be seen, and frequently is, within a theosophical or anthroposophical framework. But these frameworks must not be confused with the dynamic itself, nor regarded as necessary at all times for the transmission of this wisdom. For the age in which we live, the dynamic, that is the true spirit of man, must be allowed to find its own level of operation. It must be permitted to energize that aspect of the human psyche which is to unfold within this generation. So to put in a nutshell, and to put it very simply, the new consciousness is this: that which is rising within your own understanding, the questions which you find yourself asking, the questions which perhaps as never before are being allowed to come to birth and into your consciousness, and which are being encouraged by the fact that you find other people are asking the same questions. Perhaps you've had those questions deep within you for 10, 15, 20 years, and you've found that somehow they have not been the questions that formal religion has dealt with. And now you find that even within formal religious circles and outside, there are those who are prompting and asking these questions. They're to do with life, they're to do with relationships, they're to do with understanding, they're to do with fulfilling one's potential. That's what it's all about. It is as simple and as immediate as all that. J.G. Bennett, in his massive work, The Dramatic Universe, describes the new consciousness in terms of the next age of mind, when intellectualism will gradually give way to the unfolding of man's intuitive faculty, with all that this implies in terms of revolution within science, art, religion, and education. Basic to all this is the awakening to direct knowledge, and it is here, without doubt, that the dynamic is operating today. To ally oneself with this dynamic is to perceive that no static frameworks, whether ancient or modern, can today exclusively express the ancient wisdom. No language, whether exoteric or esoteric, can contain and adequately convey the dynamic, and no novelties of doctrine or dogma have relevance to an age where a higher and non-dogmatic form of consciousness is beginning to emerge. Whether that dogmatism be to do with vegetarianism or reincarnation, and both may have their place in the world of speculation and indeed in the world of informing individual souls secretly at this stage of man's evolution. So please don't misunderstand me. I'm not in any way denigrating these, but I would refuse to allow them any place in an alternative dogmatic system. Therefore, they are not of the essence of the ancient wisdom. The third characteristic of the ancient wisdom is the divine plan for all humanity. And here we must admit at once to two possible ways of proceeding, either from the outside or the inside. Now, may I ask you, the risk of being tedious, to, if you can, not if you can, that would be arrogant to suggest that you couldn't, but if you will, to apply yourself carefully to this, what I'm saying now. We must admit that there are two possible ways of proceeding as we approach the third characteristic of the ancient wisdom, that is the divine plan for all humanity. We can proceed either from the outside or from the inside. Now, by the outside, I mean by the adoption of a particular interpretation of history which invests it with meaning and purpose in philosophical or theological terms or scientific terms. And here you have plenty of systems and schemes to choose from. To proceed from the inside, to proceed from the inside is quite different. For this means to establish a perspective which, mindful of the outside views, allies itself with the movement from within. This is what is new. Allies itself with the movement from within. Now, this, I suggest, was the way taken within certain limits by Teilhard de Chardin and with less self-imposed restrictions by Rudolf Steiner. Teilhard allowed his inner perceptions to proceed no further than appeared to him to be consistent with the theological or outside perspectives of his church. So here you see a priest arising within the Roman Catholic Church, also a scientist, who had tremendous inner perceptions, a direct knowledge of the meaning of history, a meaning of evolution, a meaning of the meaning of consciousness within the whole created order. Now, this welled up so powerfully within him because of his applied spiritual disciplines that he found himself in a straitjacket at certain times, but he was determined, and I believe in the providence and economy of God, this was absolutely right. He determined not to allow his perspectives to take him any further than seemed to him to be consistent with the outside view taken by the church in theological terms, which formulated in terms of doctrine and dogma. And so there is a self-imposed restriction upon Teilhard de Chardin. Now, some may see this as limiting his work. It can also be seen as doing the very reverse. Because he himself was prepared to be restricted in his day by the church, his writings were banned from publication. He was sent to China into obscurity, and he died in his day an obscure priest. Now, because he was prepared to do that for the sake of the greater good, enlightenment has come to thousands and thousands whom he never knew after his day. Now, this was his way of taking the inner meaning of history and science. Now, Rudolf Steiner didn't have the same problems that he had to contend with. Nevertheless, because he didn't need to restrict himself, nevertheless, the self-imposed restrictions of Teilhard de Chardin prevented crystallization of the dynamic which he touched and released into further static form, whereas Rudolf Steiner's apparent freedom gave birth to an alternative system which may be seen as repeating the process of encapsulating its own dynamic. So today, and I say this with great respect, you get many of the followers of Rudolf Steiner who say, ah, but you must belong to the Rudolf Steiner system in order that you can understand the dynamic which operated in Rudolf Steiner. That is wrong. It is fundamentally wrong. It is to oppose the dynamic. Both men pointed to the way forward, not simply for individuals, but for the whole of mankind. They indicated and uncovered a dynamic within the whole created order, an evolution of consciousness, a movement of convergence toward fulfillment and the consummation of history. They both saw man as the apex of this movement and his conscious cooperation with it as essential to this fulfillment. They saw this as the divine plan and purpose for mankind. It is this plan and purpose with which late 20th century man must cooperate if he is to grasp the opportunities of the present moment, opportunities which are unique in the long history of his evolution on the planet. We stand at perhaps the greatest crisis point in history, faced with the possibilities of either a descent into chaos created by our own folly or a leap forward into a spiritual maturity which can match the demands of the present age. I quote again from St. Paul, who was capable of long perceptions and of taking the inner view of history. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. The creation awaits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. And to make this breakthrough, the shattering of the bonds which bind us to our personality selves and prevent us from entering into what he describes as our glorious heritage, we need now to pay heed to that ancient wisdom which is neither the prerogative of systems of belief nor the product of accumulated knowledge, but which belongs to those who have learned to see with the inner eye, the eye of direct perception.